Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. You would be forgiven for thinking that archaeology is a dry subject, but for Professor Bettina Arnold and PhD candidate Josh Driscoll, the past is distinctly wet and, more specifically, fermented.
Arnold is a professor of anthropology and archaeology at UWM, and Driscoll's work focuses on the history of fermented beverages. A dig of Arnold's dating from the Iron Age revealed a sealed vessel containing a fermented liquid. They analyzed it and were able to reproduce it thanks to our third guest, Chad Sheridan, a cellar master at Lakefront Brewery and an avid home brewer.
The group will discuss the results Saturday afternoon as part of the 6th annual Wisconsin Science Festival. But I had a chance to meet up with them before the event at Lakefront Brewery, and Arnold gave us the scientific background.
We're trying to find a way to combine the cultural and the science side of fermentation and of alcoholic beverages. And because I'm an archaeologist and I specialize in Celtic Iron Age Europe, basically the period from about 800 BC to when the Romans crossed the Alps in the first century, for people that aren't aware of it, that's a period of time where the archaeological beverages are really well attested, especially in burials. They obviously were used as what Chad probably would also agree is probably one of the best ways of describing alcohol, and I know Josh would agree, and that's as a social lubricant. So it's a way to kind of ease interaction, right, between people, and that's something that all alcoholic beverages do worldwide. So because the excavation project that I conducted together with a colleague of mine, Matthew Murray, who's at the University of Mississippi, between 1999 and 2002 had turned up a couple of burials with the types of vessels that we figured might have some type of beverage in them, we actually were able ultimately to derive at least some sense of what the contents were in a bronze cauldron, which preserved the pollen remains really well. And pollen is usually the sort of smoking gun evidence that we're looking for in archaeological contexts, because it's present in especially obviously any beverage that has honey in it. They weren't filtering their beverages the way we do now, so pretty much whatever plants those bees visited, the pollen will be there and the honey as well. And honey was the only sweetener they really had available to them at the time, so people who were buried with beverages with a honey base were usually pretty high status. This individual had a sword and spears in addition to this bronze cauldron. And luckily for us, they didn't just send people off to the afterlife with the equipment, they also sent them off with the actual beverage. So it's a kind of, it's a BYOB afterlife, you know. You have to be able to sort of throw a party when you get there and reestablish your sort of preeminence and your position in society by hosting a feast, which would include obviously the distribution of alcohol. So this cauldron contained quite a bit, actually, about 14 liters of a fairly high quality mead, a little bit higher in alcohol than the average wine today. And the paleobotanist who analyzed the contents was able to give us a proportional sort of idea of what was actually present. And two things stood out as sweeteners. The honey, which is definitely present, some evidence for a malted beverage, so more what we would use in beer today. And then as a bittering agent and a preservative, not hops. Hops is not the only game in town. What we did find instead is something called meadowsweet, which is also known as Filipendula ulmaria. From our point of view, what was interesting was the high percentage of this particular plant, which clearly was added, not just there because the bees had visited those flowers. There was very strong signature for mint. So we thought, okay, we have a proportional kind of sense of what was present. Let's see if we can brew something up. And this is again where the program that the College of Letters and Science at UWM is developing on the culture and science of fermentation comes into the mix, because eventually I'll be developing a course where we will brew up beverages like this, probably a different one every year, based on archaeological evidence. Okay, so this is the sort of first attempt to do that, I guess you could say.
Before Josh comes in, I actually want to ask Chad, okay,
sure.
Hops aren't the only game in town. Would you agree or disagree, since you are a cellar master here and you're using hops all the time?
Well, when it comes to beer, hops are pretty much the name of the game. But for things like braggots or meads, for instance, there's a thing called the methylogen, and it's basically a spiced mead. So it could be any kind of herb, plant, fruit, vegetable, kind of mixed. I mean, they all have different names in their own versions of fruit and that kind of thing, but mainly spices. You could pretty much make anything that's bitter and create bitterness by adding more and more and more and more, thus counteracting the sweetness of the honey. But if it ferments, then you're creating a balance between the alcohol sweetness that might be left behind from the yeast and bacterias, and then also with whatever bitterness is there from whatever plant, you might also gain some sort of medicinal quality, like we've seen here with the meadow sweet.
So when you were approached by Bettina to actually brew this, I mean, was there anything you did differently? Obviously, you're making things commercially here, but if you were to make this commercially, how is it different from the kind of beer that you produce every day?
Here at the brewery, we just produce beer, basically. We will add fruits and spices, but it's just a grain-based product. We do use other things than barley to make our beers, but mainly for our sorghum beer and that kind of thing. But for the Braggot, at home I would make meads mainly. I've made Braggots before, but my boss knew that, and he asked me through Bettina if he happened to know someone, and I gladly did it. But I've also wanted to make a smoked Braggot before as well, so it's a kind of a combination of my own interest along with this project that we just decided to go for it here on our smaller system that we haven't used in a while, and just gave it a try.
What was the other thing you called it?
A Braggot?
A Braggot.
A Braggot is a blend of barley and honey as the two sugar ingredients to create the beverage. Usually it's a 50-50 split between the two sugars, and that's exactly what we did here with the project. We were given the recipe through the analytical data that was given to us, and so based off of that, we took a small percentage of lenience on our own personal, or on my own personal benefit, of knowing that certain flavors might be too strong, or trying to give this the simplest recipe from the really expertly figured out proportions. So we're going off of their percentages and then taking that and creating our recipe and then brewing it just to kind of make a standard. And then off of that, I mean, if we were to make this again, maybe we'll adjust certain grains or more honey or more meadow sweet or mint, for instance. So, I mean, we only had four ingredients, I believe, besides the yeast, which, I mean, I guess we could consider an ingredient.
When you look at the history of fermentation, and Bettina talked about how you had to have the party for the afterlife, was this also a religious thing as well? I mean, was alcohol always part of religious ceremonies?
It was commonly part of religious ceremonies. Alcohol's a really important part of ritual. It helps us kind of pay attention to a specific moment in time. So if you take the example of a toast, everyone raises their glasses, they drink a little bit of the alcoholic beverage, and it makes everyone pay attention to that specific moment, which helps them remember it in the future. So that type of thing is used in both secular rituals, so something like a funeral or an inauguration for a king, but then also in all sorts of religious rituals. Obviously, one of the most famous ones would be the Eucharist.
And so, you know, when you find the archaeological evidence like this, and again, remind me, it's the Stone Age, so what are we talking?
Nope, Iron Age.
Iron Age. Yep. So what years are we talking?
Yeah, well, this particular burial, the burial that we're basing this beverage on, dates to probably between 450 and 400 BC. And I do want to say that the beverage itself, we can say it's inspired by the archaeological record. And what we've been sort of describing this as is trying to recreate flavorscapes. So it's not necessarily really experimental archaeology in the literal sense of the word, because we really don't know what the proportions were. That's one of the things. And they almost certainly weren't as worried about, you know, replicability. For example, that's one of the things.
Cleanliness.
Exactly. So they would have ended up with a slightly different but probably equally drinkable batch every time.
Right. And, you know, and this was not something they were thinking about handing down to posterity. They were just doing it for their, or were they?
Actually, that's an interesting question. There are regional differences, so it's pretty clear there were traditions already of brewing in a certain way, particular kinds of beverages. And actually, one of the other things we're going to be providing people, if they come to that Wisconsin Science Festival event, not just a taste of this beverage, but also Josh produced something that generally gets referred to as a Nordic grog, which is from Scandinavia. And he can maybe say a little bit about
that. Yeah, talk about that too.
So a Nordic grog is going to be a mix of a whole bunch of different things. So sometimes there's a bunch of honey in it. There's usually some malt that would be your kind of beer component. And then there's also some fruit. So it could either be just local fruit that was available in Scandinavia, something like a cranberry or a lingonberry, or in some special cases, they actually would have imported wine all the way from the Mediterranean up and probably dumped a little bit of that in the mixture. So you just kind of throw, you know, whatever you have that will ferment together, just making sure that it will produce something that your culture feels tastes good. It would probably be a little bit odd for us, but we can be pretty sure that they would have all enjoyed it and kind of, you know, grown up drinking it.
I like how you say they imported it. The Vikings swept down and probably stole it and brought it back, right?
They could have done later? That quite a bit later.
Yeah. So we're talking much earlier than
yes.
the Vikings.
Oh,
okay.
Yes, certainly.
Well,
so
I should also add, there's no writing during this period in this particular part of Europe. So, you know, whether you're talking about the British Isles or continental Europe, we know they were speaking Celtic languages, but we don't actually have their written sources. Everything we know about them comes from the archaeological record, which is obviously one of the reasons this is so important. And the Nordic grog, I think, had as a bittering agent something quite different from our sort of Southwest German example. That's where that cauldron is actually from. So yours is from what part of Scandinavia?
It's from Jutland. So there's a number, well, actually all across Denmark and even southern Sweden and Norway, there's a whole bunch of different residues that we have. So the particular one that I made is from Julinge. It's from the Iron Age, from about 200 BC or so. And that bittering agent was actually Myrica Gale. It's also known as bog myrtle or sweet gale. And so that kind of plays the same role that meadow sweet probably did in Iron Age Germany.
So they're all hop substitutes is really kind of the point, right?
Yeah,
so
you've got to find something that's bitter.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the key. And one of the other pieces of this for us is that we're trying to develop what we're calling a brew garden on the UWM campus that'll grow some of these less well-known or, you know, not commonly kind of utilized ingredients for making these sorts of beverages. And in fact, the bog myrtle we already have, thanks to Summerhill Nursery out in Connecticut, who donated the plants. And so Josh has used those plants, actually, for the Nordic grog. And we've got the meadow sweet as well growing there. So anyway, that's another piece of this.
And so, Chad, are you happy with what you ended up brewing for this this demonstration?
Extremely. And I actually would brew it again and try to put it into a competition, maybe tweak a few things and see how it does. It is experimental nonetheless, and every time you change something, it's going to experiment and keep on experimenting it. Flavors can change, and different honeys, different malts, different ratios of the, you know, the meadow sweet or the mint could
and different
could
water
it.
Too, I imagine.
Yeah,
depending
certainly
on water,
a very large component. Yeah. Component. Also the yeast. I mean, whatever is fermenting it could create different flavors. If we were to use a bacteria, for instance, the whole thing could have gone sour. Maybe a good thing, maybe a bad thing.
Right.
Really, without an experiment, we don't know.
Well, that's another point, actually, that we do know that particular cauldron contained brewer's yeast and not, like, you know, champagne yeast or the kind of thing that would be used to make wine. So it does end up producing a different type of result.
Bettina Arnold is a professor of anthropology and archaeology at UWM. Chad Sheridan is lead cellar man at Lakefront Brewery. And Josh Driscoll is a PhD student in anthropology, specializing in the history and archaeology of fermented beverages.
The Braggot that Chad brewed will be available to taste this Saturday afternoon as part of the 6th Annual Wisconsin Science Festival. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com.